Does the Conservative Party of Stephen Harper represent a fundamentally different approach to governance, not only distinct from other Canadian political parties, but also from traditional Canadian conservatism? How profound a role was played by the University of Calgary academic and conservative strategist Tom Flanagan, and how pivotal was his approach to Aboriginal title and treaty matters in this transformation? And how important a political figure was the recently deceased Indigenous and 9/11 truth activist Splitting the Sky? Author and academic Anthony Hall shares his perspectives on these subjects in this hour. On today's program, The New Conservatism, Indigenous Resistance, and Splitting the Sky, a conversation with Anthony Hall. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 18th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with some of the major stories shaping the national and international political landscape. Authorities estimate over 200 people have been injured and 60 to 70 killed in the blast that rocked the small Texas town of West, 20 miles north of Waco, Wednesday night. According to West City Council member Al Vanek, the West fertilizer plant explosion decimated a four-block area and that the damage was comparable to that of the Oklahoma City bombing, which destroyed the Mura Federal Building in 1995. Power was cut off in nearby areas, and the blast could be heard in communities 45 miles away. Fire from the explosion was under control by 11 p.m. American Red Cross vehicles from across the state were dispatched to assist evacuated residents from the 2,800-member community. Wreckage from the blast included what appeared to be a housing complex with a damaged roof, a middle school, and the West Rest Haven Nursing Home, from which 133 were evacuated. That comes to us from the Associated Press and CBS News. Bahrain has arrested several people in connection with stolen and burning cars while the country is in the lead-up to the April 21st Grand Prix Formula One race. Bahrain's main opposition bloc has, for its part, been calling for peaceful pro-democracy demonstrations, noting that the U.S. allied country's biggest sporting event is an opportunity to highlight their cause on the world stage. The Gulf Arab state has seen pro-democracy demonstrations for 2 years, and a clash in 2011 led to the deaths of 35 people during the 2011 Grand Prix. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International both claim human rights activists are being arrested in advance of the event. On Wednesday, a representative of Amnesty, Hasiba Haj Saroui, said, quote, "The authorities are trying to use the Grand Prix as a platform to show progress, with claims that the human rights situation has improved, whilst stepping up repression in order to ensure nothing disturbs their public image," unquote. The government denies the accusations by rights groups and the charges of excessive use of force in previous protests. That comes to us from Reuters. Authorities believe two pressure cookers loaded with ball bearings, nails, and explosives were to blame for last Monday's blasts near the finish line of the annual Boston Marathon, which killed three and injured 176 others. The bombings took place on Boylston Street in the lead-up to the finish line. They exploded 10 seconds and 100 yards apart, leaving the streets spattered with blood, broken glass, and maimed civilians. 10 Boston-area hospitals treated as many as 170 wounded persons following the attack. 14 remained in critical condition as of Wednesday. The attacks claimed the lives of three, including 8-year-old Martin Richard, 29-year-old Christy Campbell, and Liu Lingzi, a Boston University graduate student. The FBI took charge of the investigation into the bombing Monday and have set up phone lines soliciting the public's help in tracking down those responsible. The area around Copley Square has been designated a crime scene and is closed to the public. U.S. President Barack Obama, who was to have attended Thursday's interfaith memorial service in Boston in honor of the victims, identified the incident as an act of terrorism but could not determine whether the attack was perpetrated by an international organization, a domestic one, or by a lone individual. Agents have been inspecting cell phone logs and video footage from surveillance cameras in the vicinity in the hope of identifying the perpetrator. That comes to us from the Associated Press and the Boston Globe. The FBI has arrested a Corinth, Mississippi man, 45-year-old Paul Kevin Curtis, in connection with ricin-laced letters sent to U.S. President Barack Obama and Republican Senator Roger Wicker. FBI and Secret Service agents had staged their investigation out of the Lee County Sheriff's Department. Wicker and Obama received these letters Tuesday and Wednesday, respectively. Both were postmarked April 8th, and they both contained the identical phrase, quote, "To see a wrong and not expose it is to become a silent partner to its continuance," unquote. They were also both signed, quote, "I am KC and I approve this message," unquote. Investigators have not established a clear motive for the ricin letters, but have so far dismissed any connection with the Boston Marathon attacks. That comes to us from the Clarion Ledger. Venezuela's president-elect Nicolas Maduro is accusing his main rival, Enrique Capriles, of trying to stage a coup against his government in the wake of violent clashes following his disputed election, which have claimed the lives of 7 government supporters. On Monday night, youths in Caracas and other cities blocked streets, burned tires, and fought with police. Officials say 170 people have been arrested in connection with the protests, which injured 60 people, including one woman opposition protesters tried to burn alive. Capriles had canceled a Wednesday demonstration, arguing that the government might try to infiltrate the gathering, cause violence, and then blame the opposition. Capriles is demanding a recount of the ballots, pointing to the narrow margin of victory for his rival and evidence of 3,200 voting irregularities. The U.S. State Department is likewise urging a full audit and is publicly questioning Maduro's refusal to accommodate the opposition. The slimmer-than-expected election victory could compromise the integrity of the leftist coalition formed under Maduro's predecessor, Hugo Chavez. That comes to us from Reuters. In 2004, The Walrus magazine published a portrait of Tom Flanagan by award-winning investigative journalist Marcy MacDonald. Flanagan, who has recently made headlines for his controversial remarks about the consumption of child pornography being a victimless crime, was depicted in MacDonald's report as a major figure shaping the political approach and policy direction of Stephen Harper. Flanagan has also deeply challenged prevailing orthodoxies about the place of Canada's First Nations within Canada's constitutional framework, with court appearances and publications such as First Nations, Second Thoughts. At least one academic seems to agree with MacDonald's analysis that Flanagan played a pivotal role in the transformation of Canadian conservatism. Anthony James Hall is a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge in the Canadian province of Alberta. He's the author of The American Empire and the Fourth World and Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. Over the last few months, he has authored a number of articles relating to Indigenous people's justice and the Idle No More movement. He's also a past guest of the Global Research NewsHour. Welcome to the show, Anthony Hall.
Hi, Michael. I'm very pleased to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so could you first of all tell us who is this figure, Tom Flanagan, and how did he get his start in Canada?
Tom Flanagan is a professor of political science at the University of Calgary. He was actually the first hire of the political science department at the University of Calgary. In 1968, the founder of the department, E. Burka Inlow, hired Tom Flanagan. There was apparently no application even. He was picked up from, he was in Berlin, studying at the Free University in Berlin. Interestingly, E. Burke Inlow, who set up the political science department, he came directly from the U.S. Pentagon, where he was some kind of intelligence expert and trained spooks and such in the Middle East. He was an expert in the oil politics, the covert oil politics of Iran. So I would say the, you know, national security state had a major role in founding the political science department at the University of Calgary. It was no secret in 1968 that Alberta had tremendous oil reserves and would be an important part of the American Empire's energy domain. And so Professor Flanagan came to Canada. I guess he avoided the draft in 1968, and he's been teaching for 45 years. That's an incredible record. Among his students have been Ezra Levant, who is on Sun News. It's been Daniel Smith, who he helped in the last provincial election try to run to the right of Premier Redford. Redford won the election, of course. This was part of a pattern of trying to destroy the remnants of the Progressive Conservative Party to move the political thrust in Canada to the right, and he's been tremendously successful in that. He worked closely with Stephen Harper. Stephen Harper's father is worked for Imperial Oil, which is one of the Rockefeller companies. Stephen Harper did his graduate work at the University of Calgary in economics, and he kind of teamed up with Flanagan there and wrote a couple of articles. Flanagan became his teacher, his mentor. And later, his work with Stephen Harper closely with Preston Manning in the Reform Party. And the Reform Party beget the Alliance Party. Stockwell Day, for a time, displaced Preston Manning as its leader, but then he was displaced by Stephen Harper, with Tom Flanagan doing a lot of the strategic work in the background. So Tom Flanagan has a tremendously important role as an architect of the current Canadian government, laying out the foundations. When I moved to Lethbridge, in the University of Lethbridge, in the Native American Studies Department in 1990, by the mid-1990s, it was clear he was an outspoken voice in the field of Aboriginal affairs, and actually invited Tom Flanagan to speak to my students in my classes, my Native American Studies classes. Of course, his opinions were, and his interpretations were sort of diametrically opposite to mine. And, you know, he was no friend of Aboriginal rights or the provisions in the Canadian Constitution that recognize and affirm Aboriginal rights. Nevertheless, I thought it important that students have an opportunity to hear this emerging voice, you know, who had a very different point of view. So I viewed Tom Flanagan as a colleague. I got to know him. I, you know, drove back and forth to Calgary with him, and he told me, you know, stories about Preston Manning, who is the kind of eminence gree of the Conservative Party. Preston Manning is the son of the former premier of Alberta, Ernest Manning. So, you know, it's an incredible transformation of the Canadian political culture in the last decade. And Canada has, up until now, mostly had its governments based in Montreal or Ontario and Quebec. Now we have a government based in Calgary. And, of course, the Calgary School, Ted Morton, Rainer Knopf, there's a group of colleagues, Berkison, Barry Cooper. There's a kind of brain trust with Flanagan as the senior figure who developed the ideas, the strategies, the ideologies, essentially bringing in Reagan-esque conservatism, Thatcherite conservatism, displacing the old conservative heritage of Canada.
Professor Hall, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you did mention just a moment ago, you talked about the Calgary School and all of these other figures, David Berkison and a couple of the other people you mentioned.
Barry Cooper, Ted Morton, who ran for premier against Alison Redford, Ted Knopf, people who, you know, have made a kind of business of countering the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Flanagan's specialty was countering Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982, the section that recognizes and affirms existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. So he would be regularly hired by the Canadian Ministry of Justice to go into court to fight, for instance, the Métis assertions in the Métis Association assertions in Manitoba. As Flanagan, you know, he came to Canada not knowing anything about Canadian politics, but little by little he developed a specialty in Louis Riel and what happened in Manitoba in 1870, 1871, and the 1885 episodes. And out of this, he became valuable to those interests in Canada who seek to oppose Aboriginal and treaty rights, who want to minimize judicial interpretation of that. So he made, I'm sure, many hundreds of thousands of dollars working for the federal government as, an Indian fighter disguised as a jurist. He cultivated the political awareness and coached the, current Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper. You know, he was just a few months ago doing the same with Daniel Smith, who was trying to run to the right of the Progressive Conservative Party and destroy sort of what I would refer to as the Indigenous conservative heritage of Canada, the conservatism, say, of John Diefenbaker, of John A. Macdonald.
Joe Clark.
And Joe Clark, of course. You know, Joe Clark had no problem meeting with Theresa Spence of Idle No More, but Stephen Harper would not meet.
Could you talk about that we're talking about fundamentally different currents of conservatism? You talk about the Indigenous conservatism or progressive conservatism of Canada, and then this sort of distorted creature that Stephen Harper and Tom Flanagan and that ilk have brought in, and like they seem to be completely different. So
yes,
what?
But
it was depicted in the press as basically the progressive conservatives and this Reform Alliance just kind of coming together, uniting the right, as it were. But you're saying that's a complete mischaracterization of what happened.
That's a misrepresentation. In Canadian politics, conservatism is not necessarily right wing. And years ago in my studies in Canadian history, I read George Grant, the magnificent Canadian philosopher, Anglican scholar, actually, George Grant. And, he was very left-wing. I also worked closely with David Orchard, who ran, for head of the Progressive Conservative Party. And he's far to the left of many in the NDP. I'd call myself an Orchardista. So the conservative heritage of Canada goes back to the fact that there was something that we now call the American Revolution, which in fact was a kind of civil war within British North America. And the Tories in that conflict, became the founders of what we now call the Dominion of Canada. The American Revolution had a lot to do, actually, with who would develop and who would seek ownership and gain ownership and taxing powers and jurisdiction and such over Indian lands reserved to the Indians as their hunting grounds, as the Royal Proclamation of 1763 would have it. So the American Revolution on the Tory side, there was a determination that the government, the state, could be useful, that the government and state would make friendly relations with Indigenous peoples, that the government and the state would help the United Empire loyalists with grants of land, with agricultural implements, that the state could be used in creative ways. It's the Conservative Party that had a lot to do with founding the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And, Tommy Douglas and John Diefenbaker in Saskatchewan, we're quite close ideologically, intellectually. So this red Tory tradition, going back, I would say, right to the era of, before the American Revolution, I would put a lot of emphasis on figure Sir William Johnson, the first superintendent of Indian Affairs. it was his advice to London, to the colonial office, to say, you know, let's not do genocidal wars on Indian people. Let's befriend them. Let's make alliances with them. Let's extend the treaty tradition, of which he was an expert, in the Mohawk Valley. His, you know, his family, his children were half-breeds. His so-called housekeeper was, in fact, treated as his wife, the Mohawk matron Molly Brand. So this Johnson Manor was a place where, you know, this Canadian heritage of conducting commercial relations with Indian people, diplomatic relations with Indian people, this approach that eventually, you know, has moved to Montreal and the Northwest Company, which, you know, colonized much of North America based on doing business with the indigenous peoples. You know, this treaty tradition that is now embodied in Section 35 of the Constitution Act 1982. So when Tom Flanagan came to the University of Lethbridge, you know, the school that I have been teaching at in Native American Studies since 1990 and now in Globalization Studies, this was a, you know, this was an important moment because he, in a way, embodies a betrayal of the indigenous conservatism, which involves, you know, Section 35, treaty relationships, covenant chain relationships with the First Nations. And he, you know, he and Stephen Harper, who co-authored articles, you know, you can read about, you can read their articles, you can easily find them on the internet. They strategized about, you know, how do we do away with this red Tory tradition, with this centrist tradition of conservatism in Canada, so we can bring into Canada, you know, the Reagan Revolution, the Thatcher Revolution, so that we can retool conservatism so that it's neoliberal. It wants a small state, small taxes for corporations, or no taxes for corporations, giveaways for corporations. What is to be given away? Well, in Canada, what is to be given away are the lands and resources and, you know, the access to pipeline routes and such. And so Aboriginal and treaty rights in Canada stand in the way, are impediments to the agenda of Stephen Harper and Tom Flanagan.
Mohawk warrior Splitting the Sky passed away March 13, 2013. As it states in the Warrior Publications website, Splitting the Sky was found dead on a path on the Adams Lake Indian Reserve near his home in Chase, BC. He appears to have died from a blow to the head after falling on a cement step. Among the highlights of his life was his leading of the Attica Prison Rebellion in 1972, his participation in the standoff at Gustafson Lake, BC, his peace activism, and his more recent efforts to galvanize resistance to the Enbridge Northern Gateway oil pipeline. Anthony Hall will be back shortly to talk about STS in a minute, but first, here's some audio of the man himself, recorded from a public talk with Cynthia McKinney in 2010, shortly before a court appearance related to his attempt to place former President George Bush under arrest.
And our children look at us like, where are we going from here? What kind of future do we have? What kind of path are you paving for us to walk? What's coming? They can feel that there's a great repression in motion. They can feel that there are militaries mobilizing, that there are police mobilizing, that there are corporations and intelligence talking day in, day out, how are they going to extrapolate more of our resources that belong to the people? And they're saying that they're going to take these resources with complete impunity, and the reality is, since 9/11/2001, the whole corporate military industrial complex has got carte blanche to go worldwide and commit nothing but genocide and ethnocide and ethnic cleansing, and they care not about who and how many get murdered and mowed down in the way, because as I stand here today and tell you that my family and I were almost in one of those buildings that went down on 9/11, and I can tell you for the last 8 years, I have studied 9/11, researched 9/11 inside out, and conclusively found with many scholars and hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people worldwide, that 9/11 was an orchestrated inside job. And the sooner we realize that that is the nature of the corporate military industrial complex, then that's the day that we come face to face with the realities of the enemy that we are dealing with. And if we're going to do something, because we have to realize from that moment that 9/11 happened, the executive branch of the Bush regime took full control of the powers that are supposed to be invested in this woman who used to be a former congresswoman. Congress lost the power to wage war, to declare war. It then went into the Bush-Cheney administration. They seized that power. They created what was called endless war in our lifetime. That mandate has not been rescinded or reiterated in this Obama administration. What we have is unbridled corporate mercenary forces that are out there in every world, every oil and gas resource country in the world, to seize those resources and mow down and kill down anything that gets in its way. We have a job to inform the rest of the world that we are going to stop that. We have got to mobilize that. You can sit there and look at the tortures and the murders that have been committed subsequent, post 9/11. But you have to ask yourself, you can't shut yourself out from any knowledge that will lead to the real corporate, the real culprits behind this terrible aggression that is unbridled, that has no rules, has no regulations, has no oversight. It is something that will not stop until we demand that it stops. And now I think I can't sit back. If I see a truth, if I see something, I can't sit back and say, well, okay, I'm separating this part from this part and just going to deal with this part because I might not have your support because I'm dealing with this part over here of a situation. I don't care if I have your support or not, when it comes to that issue. I cannot deny my own intelligence. I can't deny my mind, my senses. I can't deny the research of very intelligent people that have all concluded the same things. And I won't deny it because if I'm denying any element of that truth, I'm denying my responsibility of having to engage the enemy class. And when the enemy class shows me that they can kill thousands of their own with impunity without the first sense of feeling whatsoever, and then they could just sacrifice the bodies of thousands of military men and women, that they can kill millions of Iraqis, Afghanis, Venezuelans, soon Iranians, they're threatening Russia, they're threatening China, Pakistan, India, Somalia, Yemeni. Every time we turn around and we get this sick, redundant play that it was Al-Qaeda, it was Al-Qaeda, it was Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda my butt. Al-Qaeda my ass. Hey. It was no Al-Qaeda, it was the governments themselves. And you and I all know Al-Qaeda was nothing but a tool for U.S. foreign policy. Always was and always will be. And they're nothing but CIA assets. This is what we're dealing with.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Okay, well, maybe what we could do is move from that discussion to perhaps a related discussion. And that has to do with the passing of Splitting the Sky, who is also a very profound native warrior. He was a very good friend of yours. He passed away after apparently falling and hitting his head. Now this is someone who's has a history of resistance struggles, going back to the Attica uprising. Then there was Gustafson Lake back in the mid 1990s, and more recently he's come to prominence as a major figure, not only within the 9/11 Truth Movement, but as actually trying to place George W. Bush under arrest. Maybe it would be good if you could just outline your own how you came to be acquainted with STS.
Yeah. I might mention that STS and I did a joint article from combining the word Red Power and Red Tory. And so we talked a lot about this history that we're connecting to, you know, Flanagan and Flanagan's attempt to destroy the indigenous conservative heritage of Canada and bring in this imported Reaganesque Thatcherite heritage into Canada. So Splitting the Sky and I, you know, worked along those lines to identify this particular constitutional heritage at Gustafson Lake. You know, there was a lot of reference to the Royal Proclamation, to the imperial government's promises, to the Crown's promises to indigenous peoples. So in making this transition, I let it be said here that we're not totally changing the subject. So Splitting the Sky is an enormously important figure and inspired me a great deal, and we had, you know, tremendous discussions over the years. He spent 17 years in prison after Attica. He was charged with killing a prison guard. 43 people were killed at the Attica prison episode in 1971 in Upper New York State near Buffalo, and at the time Splitting the Sky was 19 years old. He'd only been there 2 weeks, and of the 43 people killed, there was only one charge, and that was against Splitting the Sky for killing a prison guard. So he became a kind of famous case. The Rockefellers were involved. Nelson Rockefeller was sort of on his way to running for president. He was responsible. He was governor of New York State and sort of responsible for what happened in taking back control after the inmates had seized control of the prison. And there was some kind of riot, and in that riot, this prison guard was killed, and Splitting the Sky took the charge for it. I met Splitting the Sky shortly after the Gustafson Lake event, the Indian War at Gustafson Lake in the Gustafson Lake area in 1995.
That's in British Columbia.
In British Columbia. I wasn't there. I was not that, you know, I wasn't exactly sure what was happening. But then when I saw that Dr. Bruce Clark was the lawyer for the Spetan defenders, the Shuswap defenders, suddenly it became clear to me what was probably going on. Bruce Clark sort of specializes in areas where no treaties have been signed. And I wrote an article initially for Canadian Forum, but I thought I'll just send it off to the Globe and Mail. And lo and behold, a couple of days later, it appeared in the Globe and Mail. And then, you know, I started getting phone calls from all over, including from, you know, the Christian Science Monitor, and you know, started to realize I, you know, had a decent interpretation that seemed to be it's sort of called for of this situation. So a few months later, I got a phone call from a person who identified himself with this strange name, Splitting the Sky. Actually, his Mohawk given name, Dakachewia, means Splitting the Sky, and sometimes they call him Doc. And
I guess his Christian name is John Boncour, right?
And then he has another name, John Boncour, and his father is Italian, and his mother is from the Six Nations Reserve in near Brantford. And so I guess he had been, you know, quite aware of my writing on Gustafson Lake, and he wanted to meet me. And as I met with him and started to, you know, put the story together of Gustafson Lake, but before that, Attica, and start to realize who he was, I heard Hurricane Carter come to University of Lethbridge and speak. I have to say, he wasn't as good a speaker as Splitting the Sky, and his story really wasn't as interesting. And, of course, Hurricane Carter has had a feature film made about him, and there's a Bob Dylan song and such. There's no such high-profile monuments for Splitting the Sky. His stories of Attica, his life leading up to Attica, how he got into Attica, what happened at Gustafson Lake, the fact that the government, by its own accounts, shot 70,000 rounds of live ammunition, used landmines in this Indian War in British Columbia that's pretty much been covered up. These stories are, the system has difficulty being sort of honest and forthright and dealing with these things that Splitting the Sky dealt with all his life. And so he was an inspirational speaker, and he has spoken in many places, and he does have a following, and does have a following, and, you know, many of us are devastated by what happened to him.
That leads to the question, was he seen as a threat by authoritative forces?
Well, he was definitely, he wasn't just seen as a threat, he was a threat. 9/11, I used to, you know, one year, was it 2008? I went to, I drove over to Chase, British Columbia, where he lives, and cleared to Wolverine, who was, you know, had an 8-year prison sentence for what happened at Gustafson Lake. Anyway, as we were driving back from Chase to bring him to University of Lethbridge, he was just going on and on about 9/11. And, you know, he'd been bringing his researchers' talents to looking at 9/11. And so I had a couple of days before the class, and I really thought, well, I've got to sort of deal with this issue. So he sort of persuaded me that I couldn't be on the fence, that I had to deal with what did or did not happen on 9/11, and that it's so important and crucial to understanding, you know, how reality is actually structured these days, rather than the picture of reality that is presented to us on the mainstream media.
So he was a 9/11 truther, basically.
So yeah, he was trying to figure out, his approach was, you know, follow the money. And again, you know, at first when I was hearing it was kind of bewildering. It was like when I first heard him talking about, you know, chain of commands and size of bullets and a whole range of things about Gustafson Lake. And then, you know, he was doing the same for 9/11. And, you know, coming up with interpretations which enormously threaten the state. He, you know, in the course of that drive from Chase to Lethbridge, he spoke on the radio with Kevin Barrett. And
what were the points that he emphasized in his analysis? Because, I mean, there's a wide range of anomalies and discrepancies. Well, there's certain points he focused on.
His main thing was, you know, follow the money. And he had a, you know, he had a sort of relationship with the Rockefellers, the twin towers. One is Nelson and David Rockefeller. So he, you know, he was in New York on the 10th of September 2001. You know, he had a sort of personal element, but his basic approach was follow the money. And, you know, what about Halliburton, and what about the Bush financial affairs? But, you know, he would talk about the technology of the, you know, the internal explosions, the demolition. He's the first one I heard about, you know, of mini nukes as part of this amazing, you know, technology that brought down the twins from the top down. The Building 7 seems to be a more traditional demolition. Anyway, he just would connect. He just had this way of connecting so many aspects of things. About, you know, say 2 months or 6 weeks before George Bush was scheduled to come to Calgary, I got a phone call. I didn't know about this. I got a phone call from Splitting the Sky. And he said, you know, the first public speech that George Bush will give after his presidency will take place at the TELUS Convention Center in Calgary. And, hey, my friend, you know, we didn't plan it this way, but, you know, sort of honor and dignity and duty, we can't just let this pass. George Bush happens to be parachuting into our territory here, and we have to do something about it. So, you know, one of the first things I did was, you know, I had this speech speaking engagement coming up at the University of Winnipeg, so I focused on the need to arrest George Bush. And that article, I must say, did go kind of viral. And, you know, I ran into this episode at the University of Winnipeg, which was harsh, which is, you know, on record. I won't go into the details, but it involved Leslie Hughes and the same issues that were swirling around Leslie Hughes. And so anyway, we did go to work and we found out who was doing the organizing in Calgary, and we you know, rolled up our sleeves, and I rolled out my, you know, the word processor on the computer, and we prepared for George Bush coming into the territory. And so, splitting the sky, we went up to Calgary together along with Joshua Blakeney, who did a documentary film on all of this. And to tell the truth, the night before, I had kind of a falling out with splitting the sky. He could get very angry at times. Sometimes, you know, he was pissed off with me, and he would tell me so. And anyway, we ended up at the TELUS Convention Center, and then he suddenly seemed to forget all that and ran up to me and said, "Okay, I'm doing it this time. I'm doing it this time. I can get, you know, I can see, I can make it in the door. I'm going to attempt, you know, this citizen's arrest of George Bush." And that's what he did. You know, I kept back from it, but he, you know, I later saw it on a video. There was a videographer, Nathan Moulton, assigned to, you know, whatever happens to document it. And it's a very moving, incredible video where you see splitting the sky, just insisting, you know, by this time, Gail Davis, Lawyers Against War, we'd given the RCMP, the Government of Canada, different ministers, the evidence. Like, you have the evidence. You know, in Canada, there is a war crimes, crimes against humanity and war crimes act passed in 2000. Canada is not to be a refuge for war criminals. So it's in our laws that you must arrest George Bush, whether it's the prime minister makes the decision, but the police can make the decision independently. Politicians don't have absolute control over directing police. If they do, we're a police state. And we did kind of see in that instance, you know, it is a kind of police state. They're the police protecting George Bush, protecting those paying, you know, big money to go in and see George Bush. And so splitting the sky took it to the point of saying, okay, we've given you the evidence, we've done everything necessary, now if you're not going to do it, if you're not going to arrest him, I am. And then he, you know, very expertly sort of tries to walk through, they pull him through, push him down on the ground, the police do, flip him around like a pancake, you know. Meanwhile, there's tasers, there's sharpshooters all in the, you know, above the buildings. You know, they smash him down. I'm 62 years old. He's no spring chicken. Anyway, he gets the wind.
He was placed under arrest.
What's that?
He was placed under arrest.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to describe the moment. If you know, he stands up, he gets his breath. He's in handcuffs, and to me, this is a great, you know, inspirational moment when you're, you know, apprehended by police and you're. And instead of sort of bowing to the force of police, he stands up and he defiantly says, "Arrest George Bush, not me. Arrest George Bush, not me." Then he's walked to the paddy wagon. Then this, what we see is a plant. Somebody comes in an orange coat, and all the media focused on, you know, it was amazing to see how the media covered up this real story. And the real story was not that we were there to say, we don't like George Bush. The real story was, and he had a letter from Ramsey Clark, which we delivered in a press conference the previous day. The real message was, we demand that the police authorities in Canada enforce the law, the laws of Canada, that Canadian sovereignty be asserted, and that the right thing be done, the laws be adhered to, be actually applied, and George Bush be arrested. So instead, he was arrested. I spent the night in, you know, we were worried that he would be harmed in jail, and you know, we kept close to him as we could, sort of camping in the the part of the building between, you know, the entry and the, and going into the offices, there was a little area. We just wanted the authorities to know, like, we're keeping as close as we can. So the charges were made, and eventually a trial took place, and eventually a lawyer by the name of Davidson represented him, not very well, I don't think. Cynthia McKinney, who I'd met in Paris, she was willing to come in and did come in to be an expert witness. You know, I was going to be an expert witness, but somehow the judge didn't allow that to happen. You know, we did a meeting, a public event with Cynthia McKinney and Splitting the Sky at the University of Calgary, and it's a great series of videos. The links to it are on an article I did on Global Research CA. Global Research CA really was covering the story of Splitting the Sky's efforts to arrest George Bush. He eventually got on Russia Today through the good offices of Michael Chossadowski.
Yeah, and unfortunately, all of that didn't seem to make much of a difference. And I guess at the end of the day, Splitting the Sky was charged, right? And or he was unsuccessful.
Yeah. But then we had a trial, and you know, it's quite. So we called it Splitting the Sky versus George W. Bush. And in fact, you know, by the time the sentencing took place, Ramsey Clark flew in. I picked him up at the airport along with Joshua Blakeney, 82 years old. And, you know, what a tremendous figure, sort of this maverick jurist who, you know, was involved in the Milosevic case, who was involved in the prosecution of Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, high-profile personality, to be certain.
Yeah, and, you know, so it was great to spend time with Ramsey Clark and Splitting the Sky. Sandra Bruder and Splitting the Sky's children were there. It was a tremendous moment. And you can say, well, we didn't get the news out very far. Kevin Barrett covered it very closely on, you know, his Truth Jihad American Freedom Radio network. But darn it, you know, this was the first trial in the world where the criminal record of George Bush did come up. And, you know, the authorities, the Crown, and I'd have to say Splitting the Sky's own lawyer, you know, the effort was to keep the discussion very narrow, you know, who pushed whom, where was the bicycle, these kind of issues. You know, Splitting the Sky, though, did on the stand get to raise.
So they effectively disregarded the whole issues about the criminality of the person being, and basically
and say,
he was just
Canadian
portrayed as a...
The progressive forces in Canada, you know, were not with us that day. And, you know, the sort of gatekeeping, and I have to say that it had a lot to do with the fact that Splitting the Sky insists on talking about 9/11. And will not back off from the idea that whatever happened on 9/11 is somehow, you know, connected to these issues of the criminality of the Bush War Cabinet and George Bush himself. When I was making the transition from Native American Studies, as we call it, at the University of Lethbridge, to Globalization Studies, my two books, The American Empire and the Fourth World and Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism, you know, I made this transition to a more international approach, transnational approach, global approach. And I have to attribute, you know, Splitting the Sky gave me a lot of help because he moved from, you know, the issues of the maltreatment of indigenous peoples, the law breaking of governments when it comes to failing to respect Aboriginal and treaty rights, any kind of... When we were moving into the realm of George Bush's, you know, criminality for breaking international laws as well as domestic laws, you know, it brought us into a larger theater, a global theater, this movement to arrest the real war criminals of the world. This is a global movement. This is all over the world.
So when Splitting the Sky, I think he had left some sort of a message that... in the event that he had died, that people should investigate. Is that something that you...
Yeah, well, Splitting the Sky was, you know, he had a tremendous spirit, a tremendous ability to kind of inspire others and to rise up. And you know, if it seemed that he had somehow self-destructed, he was urging people, don't believe it, something... you know, some bad intervention would more likely be the cause.
Professor Hall, do you believe that splitting the sky, this untimely death, that that might have been, you know, these forces that you're talking about, these the international war criminals, that on some level they have, may have been responsible? Or do you take the official story at face value?
Splitting the sky in the last years was struggling with an addiction issue. And monies became available in ways that sort of gave him latitude to go into this sort of dark side that he held at bay for so much of his life. So, you know, if I had to wonder if the forces that are hostile to the kind of ideas and principles and inspiration that he embodied, you know, I would question it on that level rather than in the final moments what happened. But I wouldn't rule anything out. It's a source of considerable dismay and pain for me to have had to see what I saw in the last years. And yet, you know, we saw him at the 9/11 hearings in Vancouver just last spring, just a year ago. And, you know, there was a street band out in the road in front of the place where the hearings took place. And, you know, he was in good form and he was grooving to the music. And he seemed to have, he was manifesting that spirit of life, that spirit of hope, that spirit of, you know, being able to stand up to the most domineering, coercive forces in the world, which he did all his life. So, you know, his life, I have to see his life in its totality. And, you know, his spirit is huge. I'm looking out at the Rocky Mountains here in Lethbridge, you know, in the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, and I can kind of see his image rising into the sky. I remember him speaking at the University of Lethbridge, which I'm looking at right now, and I'm looking at the window that I was looking the other way, and as he was speaking, I saw the sky split.
No kidding.
As he was speaking, he thought a lot about prophecy. At Gustafson Lake, the group started as a Sundance group. He was very committed to understand, you know, the unseen world, the spiritual world. And yet he was a tremendously powerful political strategist. And he told me sometimes, you know, I wake up and that's the first thing I do. I'm just thinking about strategy and thinking about strategy. And then he told me about Gustafson Lake. You know, Gustafson Lake exposed the dark corruption of the state in such a major way. And it kind of was a prelude to the so-called war on terror, because it's so easy to commit to depict those Spetan defenders as kind of terrorists, as savage terrorists. We see the Harper government and its propaganda campaigns against Idle No More play with all of these images. Even, you know, the descriptions of what happened to Professor Flanagan at the University of Lethbridge, that, you know, the claim was he was lured into a trap, into an ambush. You know, these kind of
so basically a propaganda vehicle anyone who resists.
Dealt with things that so embarrassed those in power, you know, that were so exposing of the realities of how power is actually exercised and who holds power and the way that those hold power, you know, control governments and media and wealth. And you know, so he was a constant sort of public relations problem for those in authority. He had to be covered up. You know,
I wonder, Professor Hall, if maybe we could sort of tie up the conversation, like we have Idle No More, and we have the Splitting the Sky, and I'm wondering, is there any kind of convergence there, or were they somehow separate?
Well,
I mean, how do we look at in terms of this resistance to this order, as you were?
Yeah. Well, let's not. I want to sort of claim some sort of coup that Idle No More had a lot to do with exposing Professor Flanagan in such a way that, you know, his meteoric academic and political career is not exactly terminated. I expect we'll hear more of him, and he will come back into the public media in some way. But you know, when his obituary is written, certainly what happened to him at the University of Lethbridge on February 27th will be, you know, it will figure importantly. That was part of a movement that Splitting the Sky, you know, gave a lot of life to. Splitting the Sky, you know, he was not a pacifist. He was actually the Communist Party who published his major work From Attica to Gustafson Lake. And if you can get a hold of that book, which is, you know, hundreds of pages, it's a very thick book, his book, you should do so. So, you know, he was part of a continuity of resistance that goes back to 1492. He was a tremendous strategist. Idle No More, you know, draws on that kind of thinking and popularizes it. The fact that the conservative government, its main strategist, took such a fall, you know, let's keep going, and let's not lose sight of the fact that this election fraud government of Stephen Harper is doing acts which are criminal. You know, these omnibus bills, this withdrawal of federal authority from fisheries, from inland navigation, so that pipelines can be built, so that the Chinese Empire or the American Empire can exploit our natural resources, and that Aboriginal peoples are being pushed off the lands, and the treaty tradition and the Red Tory tradition and the Indigenous conservative tradition have been decimated and attacked and, obliterated, attempts to obliterate it. This is, you know, we've got to become conscious and take action like Splitting the Sky took action. Ramsey Clark, in speaking about what happened in his attempt to arrest George Bush, you know, made it clear. He said, look, at least, you know, he tried to do something. We've got to try to do something. And even if the odds seem, you know, insuperable and a David and Goliath situation, we've got to resist this tyranny that is, destroying what we hold most dear, the social democratic tradition of Canada. But it's destroying, you know, it's transnational. And so Splitting the Sky is his inspiration. You know, we need to take it to heart and continue the work and draw from the wisdom of our elders and pass on to our youth. And we must be idle no more.
Okay. Well, with that thought, I want to thank you very much, Tony Hall, for presenting us with this rather unique perspective.
And thanks for all your good work and your dedication to the cause, Michael.
Okay. I've been speaking with Anthony Hall. He's a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta and the author of American Empire in the Fourth World and the Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.